Hello and welcome to the Impact Podcast from us at Impact Wales. We're Finn and Jane and every week we'll be bringing you the very best professional learning to help you make an impact in your school. Our In Conversation with guest today is Bruce Robertson. Welcome, Bruce.
Thanks very much for having me. Great to be here.
Bruce is the rector, head teacher, as we call it down here in South Wales, of Berwickshire High School in the Scottish Borders. And he's also author of the Teaching Delusion trilogy set of books, The Teaching Delusion, Teaching Strike Back, and Power Up Your Pedagogy. So we're really delighted to have you here with us today. And we're really looking forward to talking to you about some of the work that we've been doing with you over the past couple of months and the work that you've been doing with your fabulous set of books as well.
Thanks.
So, Bruce, can we start with, for those of you who don't know you, obviously you've written these three set of books, which are amazing, that are really useful books. And I'm surprised that more people don't know about them. So we're hopefully going to get the word out today. But
thank you.
Just to kind of start off, could you tell us a little bit about kind of your journey as a teacher, how you got to be where you are now, rector of Berwickshire High School, but also what prompted you to write these books? How did that happen as well? So just give us a little introduction.
Journey as a teacher, I trained at the University of Edinburgh in 2003 as a chemistry teacher. I started teaching in East Lothian, which is the southeast of Scotland, 2003-04. I moved to the Scottish Borders as a chemistry teacher in 2007, as it happens, to the school which I'm now the rector of. So I taught in this school from 2007 through to 12. I was promoted within this school and then became deputy head teacher at Eyemouth High School, which is also in the Scottish Borders, right on the coast. As it happens, Eyemouth High School is the school that I went to as a student. So I've not gone too far. So deputy head in Eyemouth High School for about 7 years. And then in August 2020, I began as the rector, the head teacher of Berwickshire High School.
So that's quite a point to take over a headship, isn't it? You know, everyone's going, okay, when did COVID start? Okay, so that's kind of slap bang in the middle of the issues, which must have been a challenge.
So, yeah, my first book, The Teaching Delusion, came out in March 2020, and we had a book launch for it in Edinburgh, which was an amazing night. But as it happens, for most people who attended, it was the last time that they really got to do anything.
Oh, really?
That, because the lockdown kicked in about a week after the book launch. And then you're right, it's just a few months after that that I was appointed and then took up post as the rector of Berwickshire High School.
So your memories of writing your books and publishing of your books is kind of almost intrinsically linked with COVID and that whole thing.
Definitely. The first book was written and as I say, published just before, but of course is linked because the launch is linked. Mm. And I started to write a follow-up about a month after the first one was published. There was about a month. I didn't think I was going to do that, but then I did start in early April, just at weekends and in evenings. And then, yeah, during lockdown, I did a lot of reading during that time. That helped my job, but it also started to shape my thinking in a different way. And because I started to think in a slightly different way about things, I came to the conclusion that there's a few more things that I wanted to say myself. And hence I started to write a second book, which became much bigger than I had intended it to. And I split it into two different books because actually there was a natural break in it. And that's how we ended up with two and three being published at the same time last year.
Right. So the Teaching Delusion 3, which is my well-thumbed version of this, that's the book that we're going to focus on today, because I think that's a really interesting, I think about it as a guide for classroom teachers, but anybody involved with classroom teachers as well. Is that how you see your book?
Definitely. Because one of the things I say throughout the trilogy is that we have a deficit in education of high quality feedback available to teachers. And in part, that's because the people who are giving the feedback, which is often school leaders, middle leaders and senior leaders and those who work in local authorities, etc., they really do need to upskill themselves a little bit on what makes high quality teaching and learning. We don't, as a country, have a shared understanding of what makes high quality teaching and learning. We don't have a shared research-informed understanding of that. And what that means is that the quality of feedback that teachers get is highly variable. But there are some school leaders out there who really do have the sort of understanding that I'm talking about and can get into very rich discussion and feedback conversations that teachers find useful. But there are many where that's not actually the case. And what ends up happening at best is that the feedback just isn't particularly useful and the teacher ignores it. Or at worst, the teacher is given feedback that sends them down the wrong road and down a blind alley. And I've worked with so many teachers like that. I talk about one at the start of Power Up Your Pedagogy who just throws her hands into the air really and says, I don't know what to do anymore because I'm getting this feedback from this person. I'm getting wildly different feedback from another person based on a very similar lesson. What's right and what's not?
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting you should mention that because we've been thinking about assessment here in Wales a lot. And when you think about assessment, when you think about saying, well, is it good enough or not? Therefore, what do I need to do next? If we're thinking about professional learning in that context, it is all about, you know, as you say, within the school, you've got head teachers, you've got, you know, leaders of professional learning, you've got heads of teaching and learning, all trying to make that assessment of what next? You know, where are we now? What next? But you can't do that effectively unless, like you say, you've got this really clear learning objective, which is, you know, what does good look like?
Mm-hmm. And yes, that is right.
So in the Teaching Delusion 3, it's divided into, and just one, I think it's really interesting how you've divided it, because you've divided it into two clear sections. You've got your, at the beginning, there's a part one, a crash course in learning, which has 10 little mini lessons about learning. And then you have the elements of pedagogy, I suppose, the elements of teaching and learning. Yeah. But why did you feel that it was so important to have that crash course of learning at the beginning? And, you know, if you can just tell us a little bit about what's in there and why you felt it was important.
So the crash course in learning is really, it's a summary of key messages from cognitive science about what learning is and how it happens, along with a splattering of key messages from educational research as well. But this is a fundamental, really. What is learning and how does it happen? Because if pedagogy is about how we are teaching, then what we need underpinning that is a really solid understanding of what learning is and how it happens. So that's what the crash course in learning is. It's underpinning everything that then follows about the craft of teaching pedagogy.
I think what we find as well with when we're doing science of learning, professional learning with teachers in schools, one of the questions we often ask right at the beginning is, how does learning happen? And the number of staff that find it difficult to actually articulate how learning happens. And I think that's quite right. What you said is, you know, we've got to be able to understand our own craft, our own idea of what learning is before we can start thinking about the pedagogy.
Jane, I think that's absolutely right. And I've led a lot of staff professional development myself. And like you, I would typically start a session by asking that sort of question. And I do try to model in the sessions I lead what I think high quality pedagogy looks like. So we use show me boards a lot. And if I ask that question, what is learning? Then typically you'll get something about, well, it's the development of knowledge or skills, the ability to do something new, something along those lines. That's fine. But then if you ask, and how does that happen? Which is slightly different.
The key
question. That's when you get into it. That's right. That's right. That's the key.
I've been teaching 25 years. How do I actually articulate that?
Do you know, it's really interesting. Just that question alone is, well, teaching and learning is our bread and butter. This is what we do. This is our specialist subject. You know, if we would go on to Mastermind, this is what we'd be sitting there doing the first few questions on. But how few people can actually articulate what is going on for the learner at that point? Because I think people do forget, or maybe it's not, forget is probably not a fair description, but they haven't thought about in depth the link between learning and teaching.
They haven't recognised that there is a link.
Yeah.
Definitely. And as a teacher, until relatively recently in my career, I hadn't really considered that.
Yeah.
There was no discussion of that at teacher training, or when I went into schools on placement, or indeed at any point throughout my career. I stumbled across it, really, I think.
Yeah.
Because I can't remember what prompted me to do it. I think I probably liked the title of Daniel T. Willingham's Why Don't Students Like School. Yeah. A clever title, because it hooks people. He asks the question in the title. And I thought, as somebody who works in education, I really do need to consider, why don't students like school? So that was probably my first taste of cognitive science. And I found that so interesting that I've then gone off to explore that further and further and further.
It is quite mad to think that you would carry out an action without thinking about the connection between the action that you're carrying out and the result of it, or even how it links to what you're expecting to happen as a result of it.
Yeah, correct. But I think that many in the teaching profession, and I include myself in this until relatively recently, believe that what makes good teaching is a high quality explanation.
Right.
Clear communication. Yeah. Explaining something in a way that other people can understand.
Yeah.
Making it interesting when it might not be particularly interesting. That's what makes good teaching. Now, these are all components of good teaching, but we're missing something fundamental, which is what we're talking about, the learning. How does the learning then come from that? And the sad truth is that learning won't necessarily come from that. The best presentation in the world will not necessarily lead to learning. In fact, it probably won't. And we need an understanding of the key messages from cognitive science to appreciate why.
Yes, and I think that is really important, thinking about what the learner needs to do with what you're presenting to them, however you're presenting it to them. And I think it's also interesting that what you talk about, the idea that you've stumbled across it, and we did too. I genuinely can't remember where we really started thinking about that in any great depth. I think it was probably Twitter and the need to present things succinctly got us started to think about things like dual coding and how people take information on. But anyway, it's thinking about the tradition of teacher training, CPD, inset days, in-service training days like we used to have, and what they consisted of and what they didn't consist of. There isn't a tradition in this kind of analytical, scientific, really focused look at what's going on for the learner.
Definitely, that's right. And I can remember in my first couple of years of teaching, attending a session delivered by another teacher, and they used the word pedagogy in the session. And I thought, I don't know what that word means. I'm not sure I'd ever heard the word before. So I'd got through all of teacher training and a year or so of practice in school. I'd never heard that word. And being honest, I didn't really hear the word again, probably for another decade. And one of the reasons that I wanted to call the book Power Up Your Pedagogy is because I wanted to get that word in. Because I thought that's just so important. And even now I do work with staff in different schools who, no criticism, they're not really sure what that word means.
Yes. And I think I would reflect that. I mean, pedagogy was not a word that was a regular element of my vocabulary throughout my teaching career. No, it's only really recently.
5-6 years, isn't it? It's beginning to, now it's the buzzword or the word.
Absolutely. So, from your perspective, I mean, obviously you are a head teacher or rector, as you call it up in Scotland, but you're also a science teacher. Do you think that your experience as an individual, what have you brought of that to your writing?
So I think whenever you're discussing teaching and learning with anybody, either in conversation or through writing, I think it is important that there are links to theory. So cognitive science and educational research. But it's equally important that there are links to experience and the practical reality of things. I think what does definitely shape my writing, much more than my own experiences, although I do think back on those as I'm writing and occasionally I'll make reference to them. But I think more than that, it's what I'm seeing in other people's classrooms today.
Right.
I think that the theoretical construct that I have now, well, that provides something of a lens by which I then look at classroom practice through. in a way that I wouldn't have previously. Yeah. I definitely think about lessons differently today than I would have before I started to engage in the reading about cognitive science and educational research. So to some extent, yes, my practice does influence things. And maybe actually one of the most important is that I recognize a need to try to keep things as simple as possible. Because ideas and principles can sound quite exciting on paper when you read them. But then to try to translate into that, into actual classroom practice, a class of 20 or 30 students, some of whom are very engaged and some of whom are not. That's probably what I do try to get across in my writing. I try to keep it simple and I try to make it practical because I know what it's like to be there in the classroom as the teacher.
Yeah, someone once described teaching to us as a highly complex but also hot scenario, in that you have to make those decisions, split second decisions about really complex things, like you say, with all these different variables, and then there's a wasp in the room. You know, there's so much going on that it is very, very complicated. One of the things that I was thinking about, because obviously I'm reading your book in detail, I'll explain a little bit about that in a second, but one of the things that I particularly like about your writing is how spare it is. And I'm using that as a huge compliment, because I think that writing that goes into too much detail then lacks power or force. Because as you say, who is it who once said that, you know, true genius is making the complex seem simple? I think it was Einstein or someone like that. It's about turning really complex ideas into a straightforward, succinct description that you can actually do something with. And I think that that's a real benefit. And I was wondering whether it was the scientist in you. It was, you know, that kind of, right, let's look at this in a very objective, straightforward way.
It's also the analogies and examples that you use alongside, isn't it? That I think that really, and I know succinct was the word that we were banding around earlier when we were talking about your books. And you know, teachers are very time poor. They want to be able to be as super efficient as possible. And I think your books do help them do that.
Thank you. I think there is an element of the scientist in me. Yes, there probably is. There's an element about what I actually enjoy in other people's writing. And I think, yes, personally, I think I probably prefer when things are kept to the point. I agree, Finn, that for me is more powerful. What you're seeing, well, it's a distillation of drafts, because the first draft won't read like that.
Yeah,
it does take me quite a lot of time to write anything. Occasionally I'll write a paragraph and it's that paragraph that is used. That's the perfect paragraph. But more often I have drafted something which is a little bit more lengthy, a little bit less clear. And then it's keeping on coming back to that and refining it. That there's a lot of that goes into it, which is why it takes me quite a long time to write.
But I think that's a really good description of what it's like actually carrying out these improvements in the classroom, is that the first time you try it, you might try it in a fairly long-winded way with lots of extra details that probably don't help. And it's like refining it down into, okay, so this is the process that I need to use. But the second part of the book are these elements, and there are 12 elements, and then a couple of things at the end about instructional coaching and planning for professional learning. But these elements, how did you choose which elements to include? Because that must have been quite difficult, because there are things in there like success criteria and learning intentions and presenting content. How did you decide what was an element and what wasn't?
Well, I do like to compartmentalize things, and I do like to come up with some overarching banner. I did that originally in The Teaching Delusion. I didn't use the same terms, daily review, presenting content, differentiation, for example. I didn't do that. In that book, what I did was I gave more of a description about what you might be seeing within a lesson, and there were 12. Hmm. But I did quite like those. And by and large, that's what then has transferred across into Power Up Your Pedagogy, those 12 statements, but just refined into something that's a bit more simple, daily review, learning intention, success criteria, et cetera. Again, well, maybe that's where some of my experience as a teacher, but also as somebody who observes an awful lot of lessons, thinking about what the key features of these lessons typically are, that helped. Some of the elements are structural. So daily review, something that would typically take place at the start of a lesson, learning intention, presenting content, practice, plenary review. These are structural elements that you would typically see in a high quality lesson. And then others are more cross-cutting or thematic, running through the lesson, differentiation, questioning, discussion, feedback, relationships and behavior. These run through lessons. I guess in part, I thought about the sorts of topic that teachers like to get into discussions about, that they would like feedback on. I was thinking what would be the most useful.
Yeah, and I think I'm just hearing you talk about that. I think so many people over the years have tried to do something that is kind of, and this will improve what happens in the classroom. And we've had things like pedagogical principles, we've had, you know, strands for improvement. And there are so many, I mean, in curriculum for Wales, we've got these 12 pedagogical principles that are supposed to underpin everything. But I think what you have created, and I think that I really feel that there are teachers out there should go and buy this book if they want to improve their practice, because this is, in essence, a handbook. And it's that kind of, it's not everything you've ever needed to know about pedagogy ever, and, you know, there's all the detail. No, it's a handbook to show you how you can improve, but areas then that you want to refine yourself. So it's not, it's more Haynes Manual than Encyclopedia Britannica. There's, you know, it's how to do it with clear, concrete examples and a step-by-step process and why. And then it's over to you as teacher to make it happen. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a really nice summary of what I hoped it would be. A handbook is a nice description. Maybe I could have called it pure pedagogy. That might have captured it as well.
It's a bit aftershave then, if you're going for your pedagogy.
So it's supposed to be a resource that you can use as a teacher on your own to power up your pedagogy, to make your pedagogy even better than it is already, regardless of what stage in your teaching career that you are. Somebody who's relatively new into the profession, or 10 years in or 20 years in, it's written in such a way that it's supposed to be a support to everyone. But it can also be used as a collaborative instructional resource, a coaching resource. Mm. And that's where things like the power-up prompts come in, because after some writing, there's a power-up prompt, which is in a box, and it's a cue for reflection. It's designed to get you to pause, to think about that statement, to ask yourself, to what extent do I think that's typically true in my practice, or for a particular lesson, to what extent did I think that was true? Could that have been improved in some way? You can do that yourself, or you can get into that conversation with somebody, a peer, a middle or a senior leader. And if middle and senior leaders and teachers are working to a common framework, if you like, they're using the same power-up prompts, well, that helps to shape the conversation, to take it in a particular direction. And you avoid that issue that we were talking about before, where you get wildly different feedback because people are talking about completely different things, some of which are just unimportant.
Yeah, and I think that is a real value in the book, is that it is a structural support, not just for individuals, but also for schools. I was just thinking that, you know, a really nice idea was if a whole school bought it, each member of staff had it, and then your professional learning meetings were structured around, well, we're doing power up prompt this one this week, let's see how far we get with that before we need to move on to the next one. But is, you know, a reading book group style approach would work really well, because it supports that. And I know that there are lots of schools out there who do have reading book groups, but it's your book actually supports that to happen, so that, you know, that whoever was running it could just literally pick it up and say, right, okay, we're starting here, this is the power up prompt we're looking at, and let's read this chapter and see what happens.
Yeah, thanks, Finn. I mean, for me, I saw something of a gap in the market because I wasn't aware of a book that did that, that was, as we said, pure pedagogy, that somebody could just pick up and use to develop a particular aspect of their practice. That's what we've done in Berwickshire High School. As you could imagine, every teacher has a copy of the book. And there are particular elements that as a school we're working on together, but there are other elements that an individual teacher has chosen to work on themselves. And we have that blend. There's a whole school focus on one or two over the course of the year, and everybody will engage in that collaborative professional learning. But then as an individual, you have the autonomy to pick a different element of practice. Yeah. And towards the end of the book, in that coaching section, it talks about professional learning plans, and the structure of that plan is the what, which is an element of pedagogy, the how, what are you going to do specifically to develop that aspect of your practice, and then the review, when within about a 10-week period are you going to sit down with somebody and discuss the progress that you've been making with that.
And this is what I think schools are, very complicated environments. This is what they need, is they need that kind of, you know, narrow tunnel of this is the area where I'm going to work now. I'm going to focus on this and improve this, and then I'm going to go somewhere else, because otherwise you do get drawn into seeing things in this very complex, difficult way, which is just huge.
But it's like all the way through, isn't it? The focus is on the learning rather than the actual nitty-gritty bits of teaching. It's the impact on the learning of the pupil sitting in front of you.
Definitely, Jane. Yes, exactly. As we said at the start of the conversation, that key question, well, what is learning? But arguably more important, how does it happen? And I would argue that the quality of teaching can only really be thought about in terms of the extent to which all of our students are learning what we had planned for them to learn. That's the most important thing. The challenge, of course, is that learning is invisible, and the book gets into that and suggests some ways that we can make it visible. It's complex. It's complex, which is why you can't come at it with a single element. These 12 elements really need to be thought about in their entirety.
Because we were just talking about today, we're in a situation in Wales where we're thinking about assessment and using assessment for accountability purposes. And one of the issues when you're talking about learning being invisible, it happens inside the learner's head. I think it is one of the few services or few elements of society where the data that is generated by what happens is actually fed back in to the system rather than just being a measure of how things have been done. It's like, you know, learning happens, you take a kind of measure of that learning, and then it's fed back in and the learner takes control of it. I think teaching is almost entirely unlike anything else. It is so involved and so complex. So it's fascinating that you have been so strict with yourself and kept it as simple as necessary. And I'm using the word necessary very advisedly here. So
thank you.
A bit of a tough question towards the end. And so, you know, brace yourself for this one. But if you had to choose of the 12 elements that you have in the second part of the book, which do you think teachers should look at first?
Yeah, so it's a great question.
Hard one.
So in The Teaching Delusion, I talk about great teaching as having four components. I talk about the importance of pedagogical subject knowledge, teacher-student relationships, direct interactive instruction, and formative assessment. And I think to answer your question, I'd home in on the direct interactive instruction. So I'm going to suggest that there's probably two elements in the book. One is the presenting content, which is really central and is one of the largest sections in the book. And the other is questioning. Because I think sometimes when we talk about direct instruction, unless we really have a sharp idea of what that really means, that term in itself, direct instruction, could be thought about as not being interactive. It's the presentation of something, it's that direct instruction. which is why I've included interactive, hyphenated with it, direct interactive instruction, to get over the importance of questioning within that. And I argue in The Teaching Delusion, and I think in Power Up Your Pedagogy, that really for roughly for every minute of teacher talk, there should be a question. And it serves a number of purposes. It breaks up the exposition, so it helps to hold attention, because change helps to hold attention. Arguably more important, it's designed to get students to think. And one of the key messages from cognitive science is that learning, certainly the learning of things that we want students to be learning in school, has the best chance of happening if students are thinking about the specific things that we want them to learn. So as much as we can, we're trying to get students to think about specific things. Now, if we're presenting, as in the presenting of content, chances are some, many of our students are thinking about the sorts of things we want them to be, but some, many won't be. So the question breaks up the exposition, but gets students to think. And then, as you were saying, Finn, it then gives formative information back to the teacher, which they can then respond to, and then that guides their instruction. So direct interactive instruction, the two elements I would direct teachers to in the first instance are element 5, presenting content, and element 8, questioning.
That's a really, really great answer. And I was just thinking, as you were talking about that, the use of the word interactive, because it is, it's teaching and learning is active on both the teacher and the learner's part.
Yeah.
But it's also the interaction between the two participants.
Yes.
It's the teacher does or says something, the learner does or says something, the teacher hears them do or say something, and it's that constant to and fro, like a conversation,
right,
rather than just waiting to speak.
Yes.
You are actually listening, assimilating, making it your own, responding. And it is that learning conversation between teacher and pupil.
It's a much broader concept, isn't it? Teaching rather than delivering a lesson.
Yeah.
Teaching is a completely different field.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the points that I get into in the book, building on that, is, well, it actually takes great skill and some patience to really listen as the teacher, to listen hard to what the students are saying.
Yeah.
And to drill down into that. That's one of the techniques I talk about in the book, you know, drilling down, amplifying what students have said, because sometimes it's said in such a way that other students can't hear it, so that you can make whole class teaching points about it. Mm. But the skill, I think, of the great teacher is to do that homing in on specific words and phrases, to bounce answers around the room.
Yeah.
Is she right? Why do you agree, disagree? Why? Takes great skill.
It does.
Well, the
very
art,
very difficult to, yeah,
the
very,
art
very
of
difficult.
Listening generally, yeah. You know, how many people in life are good, really good listeners, and then do something with it? Mm. You know, how many people do you know in your circle who, in quote unquote, listen, but they don't really hear what you're saying?
Yeah.
Because often it is not the words you say, but it's the tone in which you use or the body language. There's so much more to listening than just hearing the words or having an expectation of what someone else is going to say and
Correct.
Then responding to your expectation rather than what they actually say. So yes, I mean, teaching is so much more than, as Jane was saying, delivering content. And I think the book captures that really, really well. But more than that, it gives you concrete examples of what that might look like in a classroom, and then a real detailed explanation and idea of what you can do with that. And I think this might be the point at which we can talk about what it is that we're doing with you, because we are so excited about doing that. You have asked us to represent Teaching Delusion 3, Power Up Your Pedagogy, in sketch notes.
Yes.
And it has been fascinating. We're about halfway through at the moment, so it's still very early stages. But I think this is what has been fascinating, is to take your writing and then take the key messages and make them visual has been a real process. It's taken quite a, a, It's been quite a challenge up until now to really get it sorted, but I feel that we're kind of on the way.
Oh, definitely. I'm so excited about it. That the collaboration together, it's producing some wonderful work. I've seen the early versions of the different sketch notes that have been produced to this point. As you say, we're about halfway through the book. We're at that sort of presenting content stage. Mm. And I've just been blown away by what you have been producing here. I think that anybody who's read Power Up Your Pedagogy will get so much from the sketch notes that are going to form part of this new edition of the book, which will be Power Up Your Pedagogy, but with added sketch notes and reflective tasks.
And I think that's really important, because I think the reflective tasks which you've written to support the kind of the explanation of what each element is, I think they're going to be really useful for schools. You know, if you have that kind of book group approach for it, I think you've then got, right, let's talk about the ideas within the sketch note. Let's go back to the explanation, but then let's try some of these tasks and talk about them. It is so much more professional learning than just read this book and let it wash over you.
Well, it's generative learning, isn't it? It's doing something with your learning.
Yes, exactly, Jane. And not all sketch notes are equal. And the sketch notes that are produced by Impact Wales are just superb.
Well, thank you very much for having a mutual appreciation society. So thank you very much. Okay. So, Bruce, what's next for you?
Well, I'm fully committed to our collaboration and our project, this enhanced edition of Power Up Your Pedagogy. I'm very, very excited about that. My role in that really is considering the drafts of the sketch notes, and then we get into some discussion about those and creating the reflective tasks. So that's going to take a bit of time.
It is.
It may well be, depending on the success of this collaboration, that we decide to then look at Teaching Strikes Back and the teaching delusion. That's certainly a possibility. I do have a new series of books in development, very early stages. I'm just drafting notes at the moment. I'm doing a lot of reading. I'm not going to start something until I'm absolutely clear on how this is going to look. But I do have the title for a series of books, and I won't share that just now. I'm going to keep that just now. But I'm quite excited about what this will become. But in all honesty, that's not going to be appearing this year. That's at some point next year.
You can tell that whatever you've done has been so well researched that it's not something that, you know, just pops out. Oh, yes, here it is. It's going to take its time. So, Bruce, it has been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today. And as I say, we've got plenty more conversations to have as we work through the sketch notes. So looking forward to those coming out as well. But thank you so much for coming and talking to us about how we can all improve as teachers and learners. It's always
thank you so much. It's been great to chat with you. Thank you both.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to make sure you don't miss future episodes. You can find us online at www.impact.wales. You can also follow us on social media. On Twitter, we're at Impact Wales. On Facebook and Instagram, search for Impact Wales. And on LinkedIn, search for Impact School Improvement.